When Purim comes around, of course we focus on the Yeshua and the happiness of the holiday. But in order to fully appreciate it and to fully do the Avodas Hashem and the spiritual growth that we can through Purim, we need to also know what the lacking of the Jewish people was in the time of the Megillah and what we can do now to be mitaken that lack, and also what the Jewish people in that time did to be mitaken that lack, and then we can grow in that area. So first we need to see what was the lack, what chisaron did the Jewish people have in the time of the Megillah that was made them deserving of this gezeira, or that the Chazal tell us existed during that time. So first in the Maseches Megillah, Daf Yud Bet Amud Aleph, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai has a discussion with his Talmidim. And his Talmidim come to him and they say, why were the Jewish people deserving of the gezeira to be completely destroyed? That's a really big deal. What did they do that was so bad? So he says, so then you tell me. He's a very good teacher. Teachers, you know, try to make the students think a little bit and answer on their own. So they say, it must be because they went to Achashverosh's party and they enjoyed it there, and they were not supposed to do that. So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says, if so, then you would think that only the Jews of Shushan would be destroyed, would have a gezeira against them, because they were the only ones who went to the Suda. However, we see that everybody had the gezeira against them of the Jewish people. So then the students say, okay, Rabbi, so, you know, you tell us the answer, and we don't know the answer, so you tell us, what is the answer? And he says it's because Mipnesha Ishtachavu Lestelem, because in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, all the Jewish people bowed down to Avodah Zarah. So many people quote, actually, interestingly enough, even though it sounds like Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's answer is the real answer, for some interesting reason, many people quote what the Talmidim say as the main reason behind why the Jewish people were deserving of the Gezeira, that they went to the Suda of Achashverosh, and, you know, this is inappropriate, Mordechai told them not to, etc., and so they were deserving of the Gezeira. But if we look more closely at other sources in the Gemara, we could see that, in truth, the Jewish people were held at fault by Chazal, according to Masorah, even before the Gezeira was ever made. Even irrespective of the party. So let's see what the Gemara has to say about this. Also, we have many sources in this shir, you'll see from the Maseches Megillah, has a lot of great Torah about Purim and Perush on the Megillah. So on Daf Yud Aleph Amud Aleph, it quotes a pasuk from Mishlei. And it darshens it out and explains that each phrase in the pasuk is symbolic of something else. It's in Perek Chaf Chet of Mishlei, and at the end of the pasuk, it talks about a Moshel Rasha al Amdal, an evil ruler over a poor nation. So the Gemara asks, what is this referred to? What is Moshel Rasha? Who is this evil ruler? Zehaman. And what is al Amdal? El Yisrael. The poor nation is the Jewish people, and Haman is the evil ruler who ruled over them. So why are they called a poor nation? The Gemara says, Shehem Dalin Min HaMitzvot. The Gemara says, this ruler, Haman, ruled over them, this evil ruler, and it doesn't exactly say this is the reason, but that's sort of an implication, because they were poor in mitzvot. This is not even talking about the Gezeira at all, or the Mishnah. It's just saying, in general, Haman came into power over the Jewish people, and we were in a bad state at that time. We were poor because we were lacking in our mitzvot observance. It continues on, Rabbi Elazar patach lo pitcha lo parashat amehacha, and continues on explaining a slightly alternate reading of the pasuk and understanding of this poverty that the pasuk talks about. And it says that that the Jewish people were lazy and they were not osik the Torah, and which is also similar to saying that we were poor in mitzvot. But the second explanation says that what does poor refer to? Who was poor in this case? Hashem was actually poor. Ki'ilu, kaviyachol, that Hashem was poor because the Jewish people were not involved in Torah, and so it sort of, in a way, made him powerless to save the Jewish people from the Gezeira, at least, you know, until the end of the story, because they were not involved in Torah. And it also, it's its own interesting idea to think about, that that means that how we act with regard to Torah really affects how Hashem acts. You know, of course, we talk about how it's important to accept Hashem's gezeira on us, and whatever He rules, we have to have bitachon, that it's for the best, etc. But when you think about it, we can really make a big difference. That's what tefillah is all about, of course, that we have the power to Kiilu would change what Hashem does. Of course, Hashem knows what's going to be, you know, a different other question about Bechira and Hashkacha Pratis, but the point is that we almost took away Hashem's power in a way, or we did take away Hashem's power in a way, because we were not doing the right thing and involved in Torah. So whether it's Hashem, Kiilu is poor, or we were poor, either way, this Gemara is telling us, at the time of the Megillah of Purim, the Jewish people really were lacking in their mitzvot and were lacking in their involvement in Torah. And this reference to lacking of the Jewish people in Torah is also can also be seen in a different part of the Gemara, where in source number 3, Daf Vav Amud Aleph, when Esther mentions, she writes to Mordechai to find out what's going on, and she says, "Ladat mazev al mazev," and the Gemara says, "Why is she using this lashon? She wanted to know about this and about this." Rabbi Yitzchak says, "Shel halo," she sent word to Mordechai. Shema Avri Yisrael al Chamisha Chumshei Torah. Dechtiv Bahen Shemot Lamabet Mizeh Umizehim Ketuvim. That Esther was writing back to Mordechai when the word of the Gezerah got out, and she was wondering, even she was wondering, is it possible that the Jewish people were over on some of the mitzvot of the Torah? Because the Torah is also referred to as Zeh and Zeh. Mizeh Umizehim Ketuvim. The Luchos were engraved on both sides, right? The letters went through one side and they came out on the other side, and either side you could read what it was saying, it was a nace. So the words in the pasuk, mazeh v'al mazeh, is a hint to the luchos, and it tells us that really Esther herself was concerned about the status of the Jewish people and in their involvement in Torah, that maybe they were lacking in that area. So she realized this also. And again, all this concern, this relates to the Gezerah, but it also is relating to just Haman coming to power at all. Once Haman and Achashverosh, once Paras was in power, so then what happened? So there was another problem that they brought to the forefront, to the Jewish people. And as soon as they came to power, they really already had a slap in the face to the Jews. And we know this from the Gemaras that talk about the party that Achashverosh made for everybody. And there are a number of Gemaras that tell us that Paras, that Achashverosh in particular, really had something against the Beis HaMikdash in particular. And this is the second theme that we see in the Gemara in the early part, based on the early part of the Megillah. We see the theme of the Jewish people lacking in Torah, and then we also see the theme of the Beis HaMikdash here. If on Daf Yeraf Amud Bet, it says that Achashverosh calculated the 70 years, it was a mistaken calculation, but he made a calculation for when the 70 years of Golus after the Beis HaMikdash should be ending. This is pretty well known, and he thought that the 70 years were up and the Jewish people were not back in Eretz Israel. So he said, this is wonderful, they're under my power now, they're not going back, and I have rulership over them. And to celebrate that, he made the Mishta. And part of what he did at that Mishta, also is well known, the Gemara tells us, is that he used the Kelim, the Beis HaMikdash, as his beautiful, you know, the finery that he brought out, that he served people on, was the Kelim of the Beis HaMikdash. Additionally, on Daf Yud Bet Amud Aleph, it says, it uses the Lashon, it says, the Pasuk in the Megillah says, Baharotso et Osher Kvod Malchuto, that Achashverosh was showing off his riches and the honor of his kingdom. And Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina says, it teaches us that the Lashon of the Pasuk teaches us that he wore the big day kahuna. Not only was he celebrating the downfall of the Beis HaMikdash, and was he using the kalim of the Beis HaMikdash, but he also was wearing the actual begadim that were used in the Beis HaMikdash. And the Gemara quotes a pasuk in the first parak of Esther that mentions Yikar Tiferet Gedulato, the precious glory, you know, greatness that Achashverosh had at this party. And it makes a connection in the wording to Shmos Parak Chofchet, where the description of the Big Day Kahuna is the same Lashon of Tiferes. It says the purpose of the Big Day Kahuna was L'Kavod Ul Tiferes, L'Tiferet. And the Gemara says, here we see the word Tiferet regarding what Achashverosh displayed at the party, and regarding Big Day Kahuna we see the same word Tiferet. So we see that Achashverosh wore the Big Day Kahuna there. Later on in the story, we see on Daf Tavav, I'm going to bet, source number 6, when Esther is going to Ahasuerus to make her request, right, the big scene, she's approaching him without being invited, and she says to him, she gets closer, and Ahasuerus sees her, and Ahasuerus says to her, Ma bakashateich, Right? She says, he says, what would you like? What are you asking me? I'll give you up to half the kingdom and I can do it for you. The Gemara says, on one hand, this phrase teaches us that he meant, well, you could have half the kingdom, but you can't have a whole kingdom. But also, there's another implication here. The Gemara says, "V'lo zavar shachos seitz l'malchut u'mayinihu binyan beit hamikdash." The lashon of chatzi hamachut also is a pun, and it relates to the word chotzeitz, a division. That Ahasuerus was really saying, you can ask for anything you want, but I'm not going to give you the thing that divides the kingdom, the thing that used to be centrally located in my kingdom. And what was that? The thing that was centrally located that divided it into two parts was the Beit HaMikdash. Ahasuerus says, I'll give you anything, but don't think you're getting the Beit HaMikdash, because as we saw from the Mishnah, the Beit HaMikdash was really like the antithesis of Ahasuerus, and he hated it, he didn't want it to come, and it was really, we see a lot of antagonism towards the Beit HaMikdash coming from Paras. And it would be logical for us to think that maybe Hashem would bring a gezeirah against us, or would have something terrible like this, Ahasuerus coming and giving us a slap in the face by being so chutzpahdik about our special Beit HaMikdash. Maybe the reason, is it possible, a person might think, that the reason Hashem is doing this, is allowing Ahasuerus to show such chutzpah to the Beit HaMikdash, maybe it's mita keneged mita. Maybe the Jewish people deserved it because there was a lack in the Jewish people in the area of kavod for the Beit HaMikdash. And in fact, from the fact that we see that the Jewish people actually attended this feast and went to the Mishkan, that would seem to be proof that exactly this point, that they didn't have the proper kavod for the Beit HaMikdash, and that's why a lot of people, again, point to the opinion of the students of Rosh Shimon Bar Yochai that we deserve the entire Gezerah to be destroyed, God forbid, because we went to the Mishkan, because we showed such chutzpah to the Beit HaMikdash by attending and almost celebrating and Ahasuerus' declared downfall and rebellion against the Beit HaMikdash, so therefore we were even deserving the Gezerah. So when they attended the feast, they showed this kind of chutzpah, and even perhaps you could say maybe that from the fact that Ahasuerus was able to do this terrible thing, maybe that even shows that before the feast we also were lacking in our perspective on the Beit HaMikdash. So which is it? We have our two themes, right? We have the Jewish people seem to be lacking in Torah, and they seem to be lacking in our perspective on the Beit HaMikdash. If you look in the next source number 7, we see that there is a defense of the Jewish people with regard to the Avodah and Beit HaMikdash, which seems to show that our lacking was really in this area. It says that, right at the beginning of the Megillah, it lists the advisors of Ahasuerus. And the Gemara says, Rabbi Levi says in the Gemara, that this pasuk, the entire pasuk, is said al-shem karbanot, that there's a hint in each of the names of the advisors to a different aspect of the karbanot in Beis HaMikdash. And there's a little narrative the Gemara tells, a little midrash, Agadata. It says, okay, there was an advisor named Karshana. What does this teach us? Amu malachi ashari lufnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, ribono shel olam. And then he goes on, Shastar, Torin. And then he continues, the Malachim continue, Admasa, Adama. And again, we see each of the names of the advisors is a pun and relates to a word that has something to do with the Avodah and the Beit HaMikdash. Admasa is from the Lashon of Adama, the Mizbeach that was made of earth and of earth. Right? Shtetar is related to the word Shtei Torin, two doves, like it's like an acronym of the words together. Tarshish, Plum Shimshu Lefanecha, the Dig De Kahuna, Bechtiv Behu, Tarshish Vishoam Yashpe, Tarshish was the name of one of the stones in the Choshen also. Plum Mirsu Bedam Lefanecha, that's Meres. Marsana, Plum Mirsu Beminachot Lefanecha. Muchan, Plum Yichin Shulchan Lefanecha. Each of the names of the advisors relates to a different aspect of the Avodah and the Beit HaMikdash, and the Malachim are coming to the HaKadosh Baruch Hu in Shemayim, according to this Gemara, and they're really bringing a defense of the Jewish people. And that, what is their defense? The defense is, didn't the Jewish people do all these special things for you? Didn't the Jewish people, didn't they do the Avodah and the Beit HaMikdash? And from looking at this Gemara, it would seem to confirm what we were saying before, that perhaps Hashem felt that the Jewish people were lacking in their respect for the Beis HaMikdash. So when the Malachim come to defend the Jewish people at the beginning of the story, what they're using for the defense is the fact that they did in fact worship Hashem properly in the Beis HaMikdash. And so we see that, like, the factor of how we dealt with Karbanos and the Avodah in the Beis HaMikdash sort of is like a pawn in the story of Purim and how, what we're deserving of, you know, if we deserve the Gezeirah or didn't deserve the Gezeirah, or deserved the slap in the face that Ahasuerus is giving us or not, that we see that there's a theme of the Beis HaMikdash and different things related to it in the Megillah. One second. And also, just as an interesting note, when Mordechai is first introduced, he's named as someone who is Asher Haglam Yerushalayim. One specific identifying characteristic is that he was exiled from Yerushalayim. And, you know, why do we care about this in the Megillah? But once we see that there's a theme of the Beis HaMikdash as a central factor in the story, we see that it's very relevant that Mordechai was a leader of the Jewish people, was someone who really belonged in Yerushalayim, and he was out of his element in Shushan. Maybe the other Jews of Shushan felt perfectly fine going to this party, but in fact, he really had his heart in the right place and his mind in the right place, and he was huggled in Yerushalayim in Shushan. He was out of his element, and he had the right priorities. And just one other thing, that there's a midrash that says that when Haman came to Mordechai with the horse for Mordechai to ride, after Ahasuerus asks Haman, you know, what should I do to the person who I want to thank and honor? So Haman comes to Mordechai ready to give him this ride on the horse. And the midrash says that at the time, Mordechai was learning Hilchos Kamitza, which is the halachos pertaining to the preparation of the Karban Mincha, how to prepare that. So we see once again that even in Golus, in his free time, you know, Mordechai was spending his time focusing on the Beis HaMikdash. So he did have his head on straight and his priorities right. And the interesting Gemara, which does not directly necessarily relate to this, but it's possible, there's a hint to it, is Source 8. Source 8, we have Amar, it's also in Maseches Megillah, but it's not directly necessarily talking about the story of Purim, but let's see if it's possible that it's related. Amar Rabbi Elazar, Amar Rabbi Chanina, Atid HaKadosh Baruch Hu Liyot Atara, Berosh Kol Tzadik V'Tzadik. He says, they say, in the future, Hashem is going to serve and function as a crown, as the head of every tzaddik. And it quotes the pasuk from Yeshayahu, Vayomahu Yashem Tzvakot La Teret Tzvi. And later in the pasuk it says, Ulitzfirat Tifara. That Hashem is going to be like a crown of pride, right? That's the crown that the Gemara is talking about. Ulitzfirat Tifara. What is Tzfirat Tifara? One idea in the Gemara is that Tzfirat comes from the Lashon of Mitzapim, like hoping for and looking forward towards. So the Gemara says, we see from here that Hashem is going to serve as a crown at the head of each tzaddik only to those people, to those tzaddikim who are looking forward and hoping for Hashem's glory, to his tifarto, to his glory. And then later in the Gemara it says, Amra midat hazin l'fnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ribono shel Olam, manish tenu elu me'elu, Amra l'HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Yisrael asku b'Torah, umot ha'olam lo asku b'Torah. That later on the Gemara, midat hazin comes to Hashem and says, why are the Jewish people deserving of this reward to have crowns of Hashem serve as a crown for them? Because they're just like the non-Jewish people. Why can't the non-Jewish people have this beautiful reward, spiritual reward? So Hashem says to Midas Adin, the Jewish people have the Torah, and they're involved in the Torah, and so they are able to have this special merit of me serving as their crown. So just to look at this Gemara a little bit, I thought it was interesting. Maybe, again, this is just speculation, but it's interesting that the Lashon of the Gemara says, who are the people that Hashem will serve as a crown for? The people who are hoping for Hashem's tiferet, his glory. What does that mean? That's a little abstract. People who hope for Hashem's glory? Like, how do you hope for Hashem's glory? What is that? If you interpret the word tiferet as a hint towards the Beis HaMikdash, or the Big Tikkun in the Beis HaMikdash, like we saw in Source 5, then it makes a little bit more sense. Maybe the people, the tzaddikim, for whom Hashem served as a crown, are the people who hope for the Beis HaMikdash. And that's what Tiferet could hint to. And then the fact that the Gemara says later, that Hashem says to the Midas HaDin, that the reason the Jewish people are meriting for this is because they're involved in Torah, maybe that could tell us these two themes that we were seeing so far in the Megillah, the theme of Torah, the lack of Torah observance of the Jewish on behalf of the Jewish people, and the lack of kavod for the Beit HaMikdash, maybe we can see from this Gemara that it's possible those two themes are linked in some way. The Jewish people were lacking in their Torah and were lacking in their kavod Beit HaMikdash. And on the flip side, when the Jewish people are osik the Torah, Hashem tells me this at the end, and when the Jewish people do hope for the Beit HaMikdash, that is the opposite. And then we are worthy to receive great reward. Hashem is going to be like a crown for us. And so we see the advantage of doing this, and also the disadvantage that when we're lacking this area, problems arise, as in the story of the Megillah. And it's interesting also, because, you know, this Gemara says if we keep these things, if we hope for the Beit HaMikdash, assuming it's possible to imply that from the Gemara, and if we're involved in Torah, what's the reward? The reward is Hashem is going to be a crown for us. Where else do we see the Jewish people getting crowns? The famous Midrash at Mamad Har Sinai, Nasa and Nishma, right? We got two crowns, one for Nasa and one for Nishma. And when do we see the Jewish people accepting the Torah again? On Purim. Everyone knows, right? Timu v'kiblu, that on Purim we re-accepted the Torah, we willingly and lovingly re-accepted the Torah, and so that can hint to us that maybe by the end of the Purim story, if we were worthy to re-accept the Torah, is it possible that we were also worthy to receive this special gift of crowns again, which means that maybe we were mistaking by the end of the story these two problems from the beginning. Maybe in some way there's something that went wrong in the area of Torah and Kavod Beis HaMikdash at the beginning of the story, but by the end we were able to re-accept the Torah, be more improved in our involvement in Torah and in our Kavod Beis HaMikdash. So now we need to really figure out how did this happen? Where do we see this in the Megillah? Right? And how can we work on this ourselves? Right? Where do we see that the Jewish people were lacking in this, in the Megillah? And what can we learn about these two avodas and why they're connected that we can work on ourselves this time of year? So first let's start. What is the connection anyway between, you know, Torah and Beis HaMikdash? It seems like if you want to look at the Gemara in source 8 as implying Beis HaMikdash, maybe there's a connection, but what is it? What's going on? So let's start with that word, that Tiferet word, that the Gemara in Source 5 says refers to Big Day Kahuna. The word Tiferet actually is also very symbolic in the deeper sources in Judaism. Tiferet is a name also, it's not only the Big Day Kahuna, but it's also the name of one of the aspects of Hashem. Hasidish and Kabbalistic sources talk about that Hashem has 7, or if you count 3 extra ones, then 10 aspects, spheros, they call them, or midos, aspects of Hashem and traits that Hashem uses that we also can emulate and that we also have and can use and can channel for good. The famous two, if you're in the 7, in the counting of 7 spheros or 7 midos, the first two are Chesed and Gvura, and these are famous. People know the dichotomy of Chesed and Gvura, right, from the famous Rashi and Brachos, where Hashem wanted to create the world with Din. Midas HaDin and Midas HaGvura are kind of interchangeable in these in the deep sources, and Hashem wanted to create the world with Gvura or Midas HaDin, with strict justice, with kind of a harshness, with structure and strictness. But Rashi says, right, that the world couldn't be sustained that way, and Hashem had to use Chesed in addition, in order for the world to exist. And that's why at the beginning it says, Bereshis Bara Elokim. Elokim is Lashon Din. At the beginning, Hashem wanted to create the world with Din, but then later on we see it calls it Hashem, Hashem Elokim. There's Yud Kei Vav Kei, which implies a kind of Rachman or Chesed involved. So there's this dichotomy of Chesed and Gvura. Chesed is this outpouring of giving, and it's a kind of a mechanism that we use in all different kinds of situations, and then Hashem uses in different situations. Chesed is an action of outpouring and giving and loving kindness and just, you know, an outpouring forthcoming of goodness. And Gevura is the opposite action, the opposite holding back and making limits to things, making structures and details. And it's just more strict. It's not as forthcoming as Chesed. Tiferet is the middle line. It's the middle ground between these two midos. Tiferet is the third midah, the third sphera, and it really means and represents a perfect balance between chesed and gevurah. It's that middle road. So we have the word tiferes, and this, now we know this is one implication of it. Rabbi Eitan Feiner, who's a rabbi in the White Shul now, he has a shir actually on Parshas Vayechi, which sounds completely unrelated, but he makes a point that's very related to our shir. He says that the Torah actually can be characterized by this trait of tiferet. He says, on one hand, the Torah is kulo chesed. He quotes the Gemara in Source 9 from Sota Daf Yedalad Amud Aleph, which says, "Dar Ashra Bisimlai," or Bisimlai says, "Torah tchila tzad gemilat chesedim, b'sofa gemilat chesedim." The Torah starts with chesed and it ends with chesed. Where do you see that? "Tchila tzad gemilat chesedim, dechtiv, v'yas Hashem alukim la'adim u'ishto ketona or kotnat or v'yal bishem." That at the beginning of the Torah, Hashem does a chesed for Adam and Chava. He makes them close. He closes them. That's an important chesed of gemilat chesedim. What happens at the end? V'sofa gemilat chesedim, dechtiv, v'yikaver oto bagai. At the end of the Torah, Hashem is doing chesed once again. He's doing it for Moshe Rabbeinu. He buries Moshe. So Rabbi Feiner says, we see from the Gemara that really the Torah has a strong characteristic of being kulo chesed from beginning to end. Additionally, in Mishlei, Perak Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Kaf Vav, it calls the Torah Torah Chesed. That's like a title or a term referring to the Torah as a whole. So the Torah seems to really have this aspect of Chesed to it. On the other hand, he says, how do we observe Torah? What is Torah made up of? The way we observe Torah from people, keep Torah, mitzvot, is by the details. It's in the structure, in the holding back that strict justice system of halacha, right? Sometimes when people hear about Judaism who are not religious, they don't understand this so much. Like, I thought it's all about loving God and, you know, loving your neighbor and everything. Like, what's with all these laws? But that's the way it works. In order for us to accomplish and to receive that chesed of the Torah, we have to work within the structure, and that's the way we accomplish it, right? So the Torah as a whole really is very replete with details and a very gvura and din kind of aspect to it. And therefore, Torah in actuality is a balance between chesed and gvura. It's very much both. And he quotes some other sources in this year by Feiner. He says, like, if you look at different mitzvot, some mitzvot require people to be very chesed-oriented, and other mitzvot require us to use our midos ha-gvura, or show Hashem's chesed or gvura. It depends. Different mitzvot are different. And it's not so hard to think about, right? Like a lot of, say, talk about ben adam chaver mitzvot, right? Hachnasat orchem. Of course, you have to use chesed to do hachnasat orchem. You have to be giving to the guest. On the other hand, we have shmiras halashon. Shmiras halashon involves a tremendous amount of gvura. You have to hold back from saying something, oh, but it's such a good story. No, but it's Lashon Hara, and it's problematic to say. So that involves really withholding, a withholding kind of mechanism in action on behalf of a person. And also you could say it about the ases versus lotases, mitzvot ase, or something active that you're going forth and doing. Lotases is something you're holding back from doing. And one other thing he mentions is that each of the avos are representative of these first three midos of Hashem. Everyone knows Avram is Ish Chesed, right? He has, speaking of Achmas Dorchem there, he was the man of Achmas Dorchem. He had guests and he was Makari people. He was the man of Chesed. Yitzchak is known as one of the Avos that was, that really characterized and embodied the meat of Gevura. We don't really know so much about him. His life is kind of secret and withheld. He just kind of sticks to the same road as Avram Avinu. It's more of a Gevura kind of character he had. And Yaakov is a balance between them. Yaakov is the one who represents Tiferet, this middle-of-the-road way. And Rabbi Feiner says, what did Yaakov do? Yaakov, who was the man of Tiferet, he was Ish Tam Yosef Ohalim. He was the one of the Avos who was involved in Torah learning. He sat in the tent and learned Torah. So there's a connection, again, between Torah and the Midah of Tiferet. Just to finish the discussion about Tiferet as relates to Torah, it's important to note that also in the Hasidish and Kabbalistic sources that talk about these midot, the midah of Tiferet is not exactly a perfect balance, an equal amount of chesed plus gevura. Because, when you think about it, the perfect balance in life between giving and holding back is not exactly in the middle. You know, people raise their children, they don't tell them, well, half the time you can be good, you know, giving to people and half the time you should take time for yourself. No, the general approach is we want people to be giving, kind, loving people. Of course, there's a time we have to take time for ourselves. We have to be a little harsher, you know, in certain situations for different reasons. But there's more of an inclination towards giving in our lives. And so the Mid of Tiferet, even though it's generally called like a middle path, it also is not exactly 50-50 between Chesed and Gevura. It has a little bit more Chesed in it. And the perfect balance involves a little bit more Chesed. And that's why it's also sometimes called by the term Rachmim, mercy, which sounds more like Chesed than Tiferet necessarily. So that's this meat of Tiferet, this balancing act, as relates to Torah. So now we have to figure out, what does this have to do with the Beis HaMikdash? Interestingly enough, the fact that the Big Day Kahuna are called Tiferet is not a coincidence. Source 10 has the Oyv Yisrael, the Apker Rav, says in Parshat Tetzava coming up, right, in the Parshiot soon, and says, this week, V'hinei ha-shmona begadim shashim eishpahem ha-kohen gadol katavu arachayim ha-kadosh zal she-ha-arba'a begadim she-gam ha-kohen hedyot lavush bahem ramez l'shem alef dal nun yod ha-kadosh shehu dal otiot. He says the four items of clothing that the Kohen Hedyot wore relate to the four-letter name of Adonis, of Hashem. In Hasidus, a lot of Hasidish Torah involves parallels. This concept is parallel to this concept because there's certain similarities, and that concept is parallel to other concepts. So here he says there's a parallel between these four begadim and the Shem Adonis. Then we have the Hadad Yeterin Shel HaKohen Gadol Meramzin Lidad Otiot Shel Shem Havaya Kadosh. That, on the other hand, the four extra garments that the Kohen Gadol himself wears and the Kohen Hedyot does not wear, those are parallel to the Yud Kei Vav Kei name of Hashem. Shehu Bechinat Midat Memutza'at Midat Tiferet. V'lachach Nekrim Bigdei Kuna L'Chavodol Tiferet. The reason the Bigdei Kuna is called the Chavodol Tiferet is not a coincidence, not just because they were full of glory. It's because they actually relate to this Midah of Tiferet in some way. And again, I don't know what exact, you know, deep ideas he's referring to specifically. He doesn't elaborate in this particular source, but we see there's some kind of connection. And even in general, we could see in the Beis HaMikdash, if we think about it logically, it's not so hard to conjecture a little bit how the Beis HaMikdash and the Big Day Kahuna were really a manifestation of this Midah of Tiferet as well. What is the Beis HaMikdash? Beis HaMikdash is a place that would seem to be Kulo Chesed. The whole purpose of having a Beis HaMikdash, right, is because Hashem wanted to do a Chesed for us. He wants us to have a method of getting closer to Him. People saw Nisim in the Beis HaMikdash every single day. And now, you know, in this year, if we're thinking about that the Jewish people in the time of the Purim story had a lack in the area of Kvod Beis HaMikdash, maybe they weren't remembering and appreciating what it was well enough. So now, it's been talking that we can really think about what is the Beis HaMikdash? And we should appreciate what Hashem gave us. Hashem, even though we don't have it now, but we can appreciate that He gave it to us in our history, and we can use that appreciation to bring us to a yearning and hoping and davening to Hashem that it should come back very soon, Meretz Hashem, Meir Yaminu, that it was the Chesed. People saw Nisim every single day in the Beis HaMikdash, open, clear Nisim, and the Kohanim worked in that environment all the time. Imagine the Emunah and Bitachon and spiritual high that people got in that time, right? And the Beis HaMikdash is also for the sake of Kapara. People make a lot of mistakes, right? And Hashem could totally just say, off with your heads, and, you know, that'd be it. But He doesn't, and He didn't in the time of the Beis HaMikdash especially. He gave us these presents of Karbanos and the Avoda of the Kohanim, where they wore the Big Day Kahuna. The Avoda of the, you know, especially Yom Kippur, talk about Kippur, Yom Kippurim and Purim is a different story, but there is a connection we're seeing here between the Beis HaMikdash, and which was central in the Avoda of Yom Kippur, and in Purim, that the Voda really was such a big matan of Chesed from Hashem that it really wiped our slates clean in a way that unfortunately we don't have anymore. On the other hand, the Beis HaMikdash was also a place of Gvura. Imagine if you walked into the Beis HaMikdash, it would not really look quite as beautiful and lovely. I mean, it was a beautiful structure, of course, but it wouldn't seem to be such a la-di-da kind of place like you might think from talking about it as a huge chesed, because what were they doing all the time in the Beis HaMikdash? They spent their whole day basically killing animals, you know? Like, they say on Erev Pesach, the blood of the open korbanos was up to the knees of the Kohanim. Like, ugh, it's disgusting. The Big Day Kahuna, they were probably bloodstained all the time. You know, like, this is not such a chesed-looking place. It's, obviously, there was an aspect of gvura there. And one of the ideas behind the karbanos is that a person was supposed to think, this animal is being killed instead of me. I should really be up there because I messed up and I sinned. And how can I still be serving Hashem if I just defeated the whole purpose of me in this world to bring out Shem Hashem in the world and I messed it up? It should really be me on the Mizbeach. And that's a very harsh thing to think, a very gvura, a good thing to think. So really, the Beit HaMikdash as well was also a place that was a balance between chesed and gvura. And you might say that it too was a little bit more inclined towards chesed, because overall the purpose and the goal in the Beit HaMikdash was a chesed of Hashem to us, was for kapara and to help us get close to Hashem. Okay, so we have the Torah has midah of Tiferet, and the Beit HaMikdash has the midah of Tiferet. And again, Rabbi Feiner, he describes this the connection between the Beis HaMikdash and implies a connection with Midah of Tiferet also in a little bit of a different way. He says, I'm just going to read from a printout from this part of his shiur. He says, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov brought the lofty standards of Gemilas Chasadim, Avoda, and Torah respectively down to our world. That's what we just said about the three Avos as Midos. Together, they represent three of the wheels or legs of God's chariot. It was the Avos who disseminated the fundamentals, the three pillars upon which the world stands to the masses, as they labored to fill the entire world with God's glory. So the job of the Avos, he's saying, was really, they were trying to bring out Hashem's glory to the world using each of their unique individual midos. And he continues, they tried to spread the splendor of God's sovereignty far beyond their four cubits. And while they succeeded to a large extent, the chariot of the King of all Kings still needed a fourth wheel in order to move properly. So even though the Avos used these three midos to bring about a manifestation of Hashem in the world and to spread it to other people, and to an extent they did, it wasn't complete. Hashem was not fully revealed yet in the world just from what they did. The missing wheel was the concept of perennial Malchus down in our world. Malchus Da'ara, and the void was not to be filled until David HaMelech arrived on the scene. With David's royal appearance, the chariot of God was set to go in its full glory, and the regal revi'i of the Merkava, writes the Zohar, was now firmly in place. And he says that's why, he quotes the Zohar, that's why David HaMelech had to originally start his avoda in Hebron, which was where the Avos were buried, because David HaMelech, in his Malchus, really was the continuation of the avoda and the completion of the avoda of the Avos. And the last point that I want to bring out from Rabbi Feiner's shir is that he says that the Beis HaMikdash was really the climax and the complete manifestation of Machlis Hashem that was David's avoda. Even though David HaMelech himself couldn't build the Beis HaMikdash, his son Shlomo did. And even in the Mizmor Tehillim that we say every day, we say Mizmor Shir, Chanukas HaBayis LeDavid. We're talking about the Chanukas HaBayis, the Beis HaMikdash, but we're calling it LeDavid. The Beis HaMikdash was really the avoda of David in his effort of and involvement in Midas HaMachlis, even though Shlomo HaMelech built it. And so we see that the Beis HaMikdash was Midah of Tiferet, and even more, it was like super Midah Tiferet, super balance between Chesed and Gvura. It involved both aspects, but in the Beis HaMikdash it was more revealed than just in the time of Yaakov Avinu, than just the level that's known as Midah of Tiferet. It was a more revealed, further on level that's called Midah of Malchut of Hashem, and that's the final and most revealed Midah or Sphira in the system of Spheras of Midah of Hashem. And it's interesting actually to think about, if we're talking about the Jewish people lacking this Midah of Tiferet in the time of the Megillah, it's interesting that the Midah of Tiferet is more hidden, it's a level that's more hidden than the Midah of Malchut, where, you know, with Yaakov Avinu embodying this Midah of Tiferet, he was a balance between, you know, the perfect synthesis of Chesed and Gvura, and he accomplished something, but it was a little bit hidden. It wasn't fully revealed and manifested to the world, the Malchus of Hashem, through his Midah of Tiferet. Rather, only the Midah of Malchut later on fully revealed it. And the Megillas Esther is known to be, Hester Panim, full of this hiddenness. So it's interesting that the Midah that seems to be lacking in the time of Purim has something in common with Megillas Esther in general, this hidden aspect going on. Okay, so we see the connection between the lack of in Torah and the lack in Kavod for the Beis Hamikdash. We see the connection between those two entities of common, you know, maybe there are other things in common that they have that a different shir could be about, but here we're talking about this particular aspect of Tiferet, and we mentioned how by the end of the Purim story, it seems like we reclaimed our strength in this area. How did we do that? It was not out of nowhere. In order to regain our strength in the area of Tiferet, we needed a leader, a shaliach, or shlicha, as the case was, to show us how to properly harness that power of knowing when to act the chesed and when to act the gevura. You know, it's interesting, actually, even just thinking about the Jewish people going to the Mishteh, maybe that was part of their problem, you might even say. Maybe they thought, oh, well, we have to kiss up to the king, we have to look good to the government, and they were using the mitzvah of chesed in the wrong time. Instead of acting the chesed with the government and saying, oh, yes, I'll join you, I'll do what you want, you're inviting me, I'll come, at that point, they should have used the mitzvah of gevura. Interesting. In any case, so who was the messenger who had this strength in the midst of Tiferet, who showed us how to use it properly and allowed us to come to the Yeshua at the end of the Megillah? Esther. Where do we see this? Esther, it's hinted to, and then we're going to talk about afterwards how we see it a little bit more clearly. She had this strength in this area of Tiferet. If you turn to the second side of your... we should already be on the second side, actually, of the source sheet. Source number 11 from the Megillah, Maseches Megillah, Daf Yud Gimel Mem Aleph. It says, Rabbi Nechemya Omer, just so you know, the context of this part of the Gemara is when the Gemara is talking about the two names of Esther. On one hand, Esther is called Esther, and she's also called Hadassah, right? So what was her name, the Gemara asked? Was she really Esther, or was she really Hadassah? So, hold on. The Gemara says, source 11, Rabbi Nechemya says, Hadassah Shema, her real name was Hadassah, the alumna of great Esther. So why was she called Esther? Shayu umot ha'olam korin ota al-shem Estaher, because the nations of the world described her, called her by the name of the moon. They made some kind of comparison to her and the moon. Then Azai Omer, Esther lo arucha v'lo k'tarat haita ela benoni k'hadassah. Then Azai says, why was she called Hadassah? Because she wasn't too tall and she wasn't too short. She was just right in the middle, just average, just like a myrtle branch. She's not too high, too tall, and not too short. Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha Omer, he says, Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha says, Esther yirak roket haita v'chut shel chasim mishoch aleha. He says, Esther was greenish. She had like a greenish complexion. Most people interpret this to mean, and the implication here is that she was called Hadassah because she looked kind of greenish, the same color as a myrtle branch, even though we're going to see in a minute that Yirak Roket is not necessarily green. But in any case, he says she had kind of a greenish complexion, or is described as Yirak Roket, and she had a chut shel chesed on her. And many people interpret Rabbi Yehoshua ben Karcha's comment to mean that when it comes to beauty, Esther was not the most beautiful. She didn't have such a nice complexion. She was kind of greenish, you know. But Hashem did, got involved in this situation and did her a chesed and made her, granted her chesed. A chut shel chesed was on her so that people would look at her favorably and Achashverosh liked her and wanted her to be the queen, even though she was not the most attractive. That's the usual interpretation of this part of the Gemara. There is another way to look at it. Yirak Roket. It's from Lashon of Yarok. And Yarok is actually a relatively common symbol in Hasidic sources and Kabbalistic sources for the Midah of Tiferet. Every color is symbolic of a different Midah, of Hashem, a different Sphira. And Yarok is symbolic of Tiferet often. And so it's possible to read this comment of Yeshua ben Karcha. We'll get to the other two comments in a minute, but maybe what Rabbi Yehoshua ben Karcha is saying is that she had this midah of Tiferet, and then the chut shel chesed mashocha leha, maybe is that possible that that's the slight incline toward chesed that Tiferet has that we spoke about earlier. And it's funny because talk about green and Purim. When I was in high school, one year I decided to go to Purim Suda to a family by the name of Green, to the Green family. That's their name. I was very excited. And I thought I'd be a little bit funny. So So I decided that for my Purim costume, for the Suda anyway, I was going to dress entirely in green. So I got a green flip-flops and a green skirt and a green top and a green, you know, I even, my first manicure ever, I decided that would be a little crazy. I went to go get a manicure and I got a green manicure. And the first manicure I ever got was, like, not that I get manicures that often, but I decided to really go all out and I'm going to the greens, I'm going to be really funny, I'm going to be all green. So I also decided to give them green shelf menus. So I put in a green apple and a couple other things. I put in green ketchup. Those were the days when, you know, green ketchup was the coolest, you know, latest thing. and I thought it was really funny. And whatever, it was very nice. It was fun. Little did I realize that there seems to be a very deep connection between green and Purim, right? And let's see how that plays out. Again, it's green. We're going to say in a minute that maybe Yarok or Yurak Roket is not exactly just pure green, but it definitely could be green. And that's the symbol of Tiferet. And it's interesting because once you understand that, then the comment of Ben Azai makes a lot more sense. Because Ben Azai said, well, she's called Hadassah because just like a myrtle branch is not too tall and not too short, so also Esther was not too tall and not too short. What do we care about how tall Esther was? A tall person, you know, if he's talking about the beauty, a tall or short person would be beautiful, like, in any case, like, what difference does it make to us how tall she was? That she was a Benoni, like, very nice. She was average height. Like, you're going to also tell us how many inches she was? Like, what's going on here? So if you interpret Yurak Roket as implying that she had the Mitzvah of Tiferet, perhaps Ben Azai is really saying something similar to Rabbi Yoshua ben Karkla, just in different wording. He's saying she was a Benoni. She was right in the middle. Maybe the Hadassah also symbolizes this Mitzvah. I don't know. Actually, Rabbi Tzinyachani Jurabel does say that a myrtle branch, she points out that myrtle branch, we talked about this Sukkot time, right? An Eshrog has a smell and a taste. A Rava has neither smell nor taste. Rabbi Tzinyachani says that a myrtle branch, it has a smell, but it doesn't have a taste. It's got one, it doesn't have the other. It, like, knows, Ki'ilu, when's the right time to have one thing and when's the right time not to have something. It's yes, but it's no. It's a balance between two different extremes. And that's the same mitzvah of Tiferet, which is the same mitzvah of the Benoni that Ben Azai describes, and the same idea that's symbolized by the color Yarok. So we have this interesting symbol of Esther. So now to explain that point that I mentioned about what color Yarok actually is, in the Kahati Mishnayos in Negayim, Perek Yud Aleph, Mishnah Dalet, he quotes a Tosefta. And the Mishnah there is talking about Taras, because one of the colors of Taras, of the house, or of the clothes, is that it could show up as Yurak Rok, which is seems to be the same color as Yurak Roket that Esther was. And he quotes a Tosefta where there's machloket of exactly what color Yurak Rok is. He says, Rabbi Eliezer says, Yarok is the color of wax, or yolk of an egg, like a yellowish color. Whereas someone else, Simchus, says that it's the color of like a peacock feather or a palm leaf, in other words, green. So we see that, and this comes up in other places as well, where it's a little bit of machlokas. Some people say that Yarok or Yurak Rok could refer to yellow, and some people say it could refer to green. So whatever that means the symbol of Tiferet is either yellow or green, or maybe somewhere in between. If you look at it scientifically, it's interesting. Hashem made this world unbelievable. There are connections. If you look in the spiritual Torah world, there are connections that can be found and symbolism for them that can be found even in the natural world. If you look at the way Hashem created the details of this world, it's unbelievable to see the chokhmah that is behind it. I heard it quoted in the name of Rebbetzin Heller that she pointed out that Yarok symbolizes like a balance, this middle path. And when you look at the spectrum, we have the colors in the spectrum, right? Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, Roy G. Biv. And the middle one, she says, is green. So the middle color is actually the color which represents the middle path. If you look at it even more detailed in the science, it's unbelievable how this works out. Because how do colors work? Right? There's white light, which is composed of different wavelengths of different colors. And when the light hits the surface, some of the wavelengths are absorbed into that surface, and some of the wavelengths bounce back and into our eyes. And whatever wavelengths bounce into our eyes back, that's the color that we see the object as. So like with green, for instance, the wavelengths in the white light hits the green object, and then the wavelength for green is what comes back that our eye sees. So the thing is, there also is a whole span of the spectrum, right? There's types of light and waves in the air that we can't see. We can't see microwaves, we can't see radio waves, we can't see infrared, you know, waves, but a very narrow band of the spectrum of light and waves in the air is the visible spectrum. And the measurement for that in science is between 400 and 700 nanometers, very, very tiny lengths. Any wavelength which measures between 400 and 700 wavelengths is seen to our eyes as colors when we look around. And each color has a different length of a wavelength. Like it goes, you know, frequencies, it goes up and down, and the length of it is different for different colors. What is the wavelength for green and for yellow? And the wavelength for green measures, the wavelength for green measures out to be 510 nanometers, and the wavelength for yellow measures out to be 570 nanometers. What is exactly in between 400 and 700 nanometers? 550 is exactly between 400 and 700. What color comes out to 550 nanometers? What wavelength is that? It's right between green and yellow. So even in the natural world that Hashem created, He hinted to us that there's this symbol and this idea of Tiferet, of the middle ground, which has a symbol of Yarok, of green or yellow or greenish yellow. Very interesting. Okay, so we see that hypothetically Esther has this Midah, and she's described using a symbol that hints to this Midah. But where do we see that in her life? This is still pretty abstract, right? Why do we think that Esther is so good in this area that she knew when to balance Chesed and Gvura? Let's look a little bit at the Megillah, right? Early in the Megillah, Mordechai tells Esther when she becomes the queen, she shouldn't tell what her nation is. She shouldn't tell them about her origins. And she doesn't. She follows that piece of advice. She doesn't say a word about that she's Jewish in the palace. That involves Midah of Gvura, right? She's holding back. She's not bringing forth and giving forth information. It's a holding back Gvura kind of action going on. Later in the story, though, she doesn't only use Midah of Gvura about her origin. She doesn't keep it herself the whole time. Later on, she reveals it, but at the right time and strategically. She doesn't even say it straight out. She invites them to the party, and then she says, there's someone who's out to get my people. She doesn't exactly even say she's Jewish, but obviously becomes apparent when she points to Haman as the perpetrator, the person who wants to destroy your nation. So later, she is able to use a kind of action of chesed, of giving forth, of openness, when it's appropriate. Additionally, we see from the Gemara that she used this in a different context as well. In Source 12, when she tells Mordechai, Leith Knoset Kol Yehudim, she says, gather them together, right? Because I want to go approach Achashverosh to, you know, in order to save the Jewish people. The Pasuk says, Arasher Lo Kedat. Lo Kedat sounds like it's saying something about against the natural, against the rules or against the way things go. What does it mean? What is the implication? The Gemara asks. So Rabbi Abba says, Shelo Kedat Haya, Shebechol Yom Vayom Arachshav Be'ones, Vachshav Beratzon. Rabbi Abba is saying the fact that Esther is going to approach Achashverosh without being invited, it almost implies that she's approaching him almost to have relations or even to say that she's available in that kind of a way. And until this point, Rabbi Abba point said, it was the right way. She went about things the proper way. It was onis. Anytime she had to be together with Achashverosh, she couldn't help it. She was in this horrible, terrible situation. It was an onis situation. She held back. She used the means of Kavura as much as she could, but she couldn't completely, and that's the way things went. However, now, she's going to go with a midah of chesed. She's going to, and chesed, we know in the Torah is also referred, you know, as a word that's used to refer to relations because it's an action of giving. And now she's going to go baratso, and she's going to go willingly to Achashverosh, even if that wasn't really what she wanted to do. But she's making a gesture to him that might have implication. She said no. She's going to do that, even if it's lo kedat, even if it's against the rules of what she's really supposed to do in her position Jewishly, you know, the way you would think, because she realizes that's what's necessary in order to save the Jewish people at this point in time, even though anyone would think she's crazy for using an action that's a chesed kind of action. No, she realizes it's the right time now. And then she says, She says to Mordechai, if I'm lost, I'm lost. Avadati, just like I was lost from my father's house, just like I'm an orphan, Esther said. So also, if the fact that I'm going to Ratzon Tachashverosh means that I can no longer be married to Mordechai, so be it. So then I'm lost. And she just realized, no matter what sacrifice it took, it's an amazing lesson in the Siras Nefesh. You know, when to act b'chesed, when to act b'gvura, sometimes it's a whole lot easier to act one way or the other. You know, of course, it's easier just to give in to the kid. It's just easier to give in to your friend. They're bugging you to say the Lashon Hara. They're bugging you to do something that you really know is not in your best interest. It's easier to act b'chesed. And maybe you'd even be losing out if you didn't act b'chesed. But it may be the time to act b'gvura, or vice versa. You know, maybe it's easier to say, I'm going to take care of myself right now, but the right thing to do is really to go the extra mile and to do chesed for somebody else. Everything depends on the situation. And we really learned that from Esther, the fact that she was so moserat nefesh in, you know, to save the Jewish people, and she knew when to harness these different kohot, when to use chesed and when to use gevurah. So she really teaches us this message of midav teferet, and we even see that other people saw her that way as well. If you look at the next source 13 on Dr. Gimel Amud Aleph of the Gemara, it says from the pasuk in the Megillah about Tehiyeh Esther Nosat Chayin, that Esther found favor and people died. Our Moravi Elazar, he says, Lamein shelakol echad ve'echad nidmitalo ki'umato. The fact that she found favor in people's eyes tells us, implies that everybody in the kingdom saw Esther as if they looked at her and it appeared to them as though she came from their nation. In other words, she was able to relate to in some way, or they were able to relate to her. No matter what their nation was, you could, you know, expand this interpretation loosely, no matter what mida they had, she was had a mixture of midos. That's what Tiferet's all about. That's who Esther was. Esther had this and she had this. She knew this extreme and that extreme, and she knew when to use it, and people saw all the aspects in her, and that's, you know, important characteristic for teachers and for friends. Even if you know that your personal character traits are more inclined in one direction, sometimes to help a friend or to relate to a student or to do kiruv or to help a family member, whatever it is, sometimes we need to kind of pull on the opposite mida and try to relate to someone in a different way also. We need to be able to have different aspects in us, even though, of course, you know, we're all entitled to be our own personalities, but this koach of Tiferet is really a very powerful thing that needs to be harnessed the right way. As a side point, just going back a little bit to that in the Gemara before, where it, you know, she's described as Hadass in Source 11, the first part of the first opinion of Rabbi Nechemiah says that she was called Esther because people called her by the name of the moon. So it's just interesting to, as a side point, that the moon is often a symbol of not Tiferet but Malchut, the Midah of Malchut that we mentioned before. The Beit HaMikdash really embodies that full manifestation of Hashem's glory in the world, that Midah of Malchut, that is symbolized by the moon that people called Esther by. So we see that Esther had the more hidden koach of Tiferet from the fact that she was Yirak Roket, and, you know, the descriptions of her. But something about her also related to the moon, to Malchut. She was able to take that hidden glory of Hashem using her the different kohot that she had, the chesed and the gevurah, and she was able to bring it to revelation. And that's what people talk about. It's a common thing, a pun kind of. People say Megillah Esther. What does Megillah Esther mean? Megillah Esther. Look at the words. Megillat Esther. The Megillah is all about the Giloy, the revelation of the Hester, of what's hidden. And that's really who Esther was herself. Esther had things hidden inside of her. She used Gvura. She was really a level of Tiferet, a hidden Benoni, in, you know, middle path. She knew when to use both. She was strategic. She was cunning. She knew when to use different midot, but on a hidden level at the beginning, and later on, she was also able to bring it to the level of Malchut, of Estaher, like the moon. And through her, Hashem's glory became revealed. Through the Purim story and her actions, we're able to find Hashem in the Megillah, even though it's done in a hidden way. We're able to see it later on in a more revealed way as well. That's what this time is all about, right? Looking for the Hester Panim. And her Mizut of Tiferet is what brought about the Geula and the Yeshua of Purim. It's interesting to note also that that the term in, you know, maybe Yarok, Yarok, Roket means yellow, maybe it means green. But if we're talking about green for a minute here, in Chazal, a lot of times when they refer to the color of green, They use the term, they don't say arok, they use the term karchi, which means the leek colored, right? A leek is, the vegetable is green. And there's a rabbi, Rabbi Yechiel Bar Lev Rothschild, who comments on this and says that the term karti hints to another term, karat din. Sounds like the yihirotzons we make on Rosh Hashanah, right? We have a karti, we have our leek as one of our signs, and we hope that it should be Hashem's ratzon that he's korat din. He cuts off and gets rid of any negative judgment that's waiting for us. And it's interesting because through this midah, you know, and Tiferet is a rachamim kind of midah. As we mentioned before, it involves a little bit more chesed, even though it's a balance. So it's interesting to note, as a side point, that the Yeshua and the cutting off, the breaking of the Gezerah, where Hashem was korat din for us on Purim, came about through the means of a karti-colored symbol, the symbol of karti, the symbol of green or yellowish-green, which is embodied by Esther. Very interesting. And again, as we mentioned before, not only did Esther use this Tiferet Midah herself personally to bring the Yeshua, but apparently it seems to be that the Jewish nation as a whole were able to learn from her and to recognize and internalize this Midah of balance and use it properly at the end of the Purim story. As we said before, Kimu V'Kiblu, they were able to accept the Torah, which is Chesed and Gvura, and also we see they were also able to reach the level afterwards of being deserving of the Beis HaMikdash, because what happens later on, not so long after the story of the Beis HaMikdash, not so long after the story of Purim, we were able to get a second Beis HaMikdash back again. Apparently, the Jewish people were worthy of having Beis HaMikdash, which was a place of Tiferet and Malchut as well. And it's interesting, if you look in source 14, in Sefer Ezra, Perek Dalad, Pasuk Kaf Dalad, there's a mention at the end of the Pasuk of the Malchut of Daryavesh Melch Paras, that the Beis HaMikdash was rebuilt in Yerushalayim during the time of a king Daryavesh, who was the king of Paras. Who was this king Daryavesh Melch Paras? Rashi says, when was the Beis HaMikdash built again? It was built during the reign of Daryavesh Melch Paras, She'achar Koresh Melch Achashverosh, Shalakach Esther, Ve'achar Achashverosh Melch Daryavesh Beno Shalachashverosh, Shlu Ben Esther. He mentions, he says, I mean, he continues on calculating the years, but Rashi says, who was this Melch Daryavesh Melch Paras? He was the son of Esther and Achashverosh. So Esther herself gave forth, you know, her progeny, her child, was the one who brought about, it's interesting, it kind of almost makes you think of David and Shlomo a little bit. David Amelch, and, or, you know, Yaakov and David and Shlomo Amelch. Like, Yaakov had this meat of Tiferet. He had the perfect balance, and he started bringing about Hashem's name in the world. But David and Shlomo in the Beis HaMikdash were the ones who really brought it out to its full manifestation, the form of the Beis HaMikdash. Similarly, Esther, even though she's described somewhat as having the Midah of Malchut, she seems to have a strong strength in the area of Tiferet, a more hidden balance between Chesed and Gevura. But her son, Daryavesh, was able to fully reveal that in the form of the Beis HaMikdash, which apparently the Jewish people were deserving of later on. And again, this is hinted to once more in the Megillah. In Source 15, in Perek Chet of Esther, is the famous Pasuk, Lahudim Haita Or V'Simcha V'Sasun V'Ikar. And what is that pasuk all about? What does that mean? The Jews had light and happiness and joy and preciousness. Like, what do they have? What does that mean? So the Gemara says, Amar Rav Yehuda, the Gemara says each term in this pasuk refers to something else. And some opinions say that Haman had outlawed certain mitzvahs, and so that's why each of these words refers to a different mitzvah. That once Haman was hanged, so then the Jews were able to re-accept these particular mitzvahs. But we're going to see that many of these actually refer to the Midah of Tiferet also. Rabbi Huda says, Ora zu Torah, and each opinion brings a pasuk that supports it, right? Torah, because ner mitzvah of the Torah, or that relates light and Torah. Ora refers to Torah. Simcha is Yom Tov, is a hint to Yom Tov. Sasson refers to Bris Milah, and Tefillin, and Yikar refers to Tefillin. So, I don't know what the connection between Sasson and Milah is to Tiferet exactly, but it seems that, if you think about it, the other ones actually refer to Tiferet. Ora zu Torah. What about Torah? We've been talking all along. Torah is Tiferet. It's the perfect balance between Chesed and Gvura. And what about Simcha? Simcha is Yom Tov. Yom Tov is a time when, where do people go? The Moadim. We're meeting Hashem where? In the Beis HaMikdash. The Regalim. That's the time to go to the Beis HaMikdash, which, as we said, is the place of Tiferet as well, Tiferet and Malchut. And additionally, in the next source, Rav Tzadok HaKohen from Lublin, says specifically, he says, Yom Tov v'Shabbos, Yom Tov Shabbat, Him Dugma Nidrachu Marav, Shem Tefer Umalchut Yadua. So Yichud Hakadosh Baruch Hu Uchnesa Yisrael. He makes parallels again. This Hasidic parallel going on. He says there's Yom Tov and there's Shabbat. There are two categories. There's Yom Tov and there's Shabbos. In the Yom Tov category is East, is parallel to Yom Tov, and Tefer, the meat of Tefer is also parallel to Yom Tov and East. Whereas Shabbos is parallel to the West and is parallel to meat of Malchus. And there's Hakadosh Baruch Hu relates to the meat of Tefer, and Knesset Yisrael, the Jewish people, relate to the meat of Malchus. And so we see Yom Tov here is a parallel for Midah of Tiferet very clearly in Rav Tzadok. So that's Yom Tov relates to Tiferet. And again, I don't know about Mila. If anyone has any ideas, you can think about that or look into that. But the last one, Yikar, is Tefillin. And it's interesting because in many Hasidic sources, Hasidic and Kabbalah, Tefillin is actually a symbol, another parallel and symbol of Tiferet. And we say that in Shul and Shabbos also. We say in Anamis Miro, we say, Pe'ero alai ufe'eri alav. Pe'ero and fe'eri is lashon tiferet, right? It's the same shoresh. If you ever looked in the art scroll footnote on that part, the art scroll footnote says, what are we referring to? What's our pe'er and Hashem's pe'er? The pe'er is the tefillin, it says. It says, we have our tefillin where Hashem's pe'er, Hashem's tiferet is on us, where we think about Hashem and our tefillin, praise Hashem, and, you know, the Shema is the tefillin. And Hashem, Ki'ilu, has some kind of tefillin as well, which is our pairs on him is talks about, you know, that we're one as well. And there's a connection here between tefillin and pair. So all these things, like Hutim Haita Orv, Simcha V'Sosim Yikar, maybe because we see connections to the Midah of Tiferet, maybe one way to interpret that pasuk is that what do the Jewish people have? What do they gain? What do they accomplish? What tikkun did they make? How do they grow spiritually by the end of the Purim story? In the area of Tiferet. And hopefully we can go through a transformation of ourselves also during the time of Purim. Just another interesting note, you know, Rav Tzadok says, we just saw that the east, direction of east is also a symbol of Tiferet. And one thing about east is that there's Mesorah that Perek Kaf Bet of Tehillim, is, which is Lam Naseach Al Ayalat HaShachar, is the Perek of Tehillim that Esther said when she was approaching Ahasuerus to invite him to the party. It was she used that to daven Hashem. And what does that mean? Lam Natzeach Al Ayalat HaShachar. Ayalat HaShachar, what does that mean? One translation of it, reverse translates it this way, is it means Lam Natzeach for the conductor regarding the strengthening of the dawn. Ayalat HaShachar. What's the dawn? The sun rises in the east. And that's in Mizrach. And that also could be a hint to Tiferet. So hopefully we can grow in this area and really think about when we're using Chesed and when we're using Gvura during this time of Purim. There's one last symbolism that I want to mention for Yarok that's different than this whole Tiferet idea. I'm talking about Esther Yarok Roket, right? What does that mean? The author of the Musar Sefer, Tomer and Devora, suggests a different symbolism for the color Yarok. And he interprets Yarok as referring to green. He says, Yarok symbolizes a level and a stage in Hashem's creation of the world, and Hashem's development, the evolvement, the Hishtalshalus, it's called, of the world, that's known as Bina. People may have heard from different modern-day teachers and teachers of Torah that there's different kohot, right? There's Chachma and there's Bina, different types of knowledge. Chachma is sort of like an outpouring of ideas, brainstorming, straight just coming forth. Whereas Bina is an analysis of those ideas. And those two things need to happen before any kind of creation can happen. People have read about it, right, Rabbi Katz, or a number of different people refer to this concept, and they point out, like, when someone writes a book, for example, they need the preliminary intellectual stages of Chochmah and Bina. They have to come forth with ideas and then analyze them properly. And only after they've done that can they actually create something, can they actually write a book and create that new entity of a book. And the same thing happens with human beings, right? There's a zera and then there's a womb, and there needs to be a nurturing and development before a child can be born and there can be creation. And the same thing happened when Hashem created the world. He used a kind of koach of Chochmah and Bina, and Bina was what needed to happen right before creation happened. So the author of Tomer and Devora says that Yarok, that color of green, symbolizes that pre-creation stage of Bina. And he says, why is the color of Yarok a symbol for that? Why green? He says, look at the natural world. Again, the spiritual and the natural world have parallels. He says, what's green in the natural world? Unripe fruit. Fruit before it ripens, you already have a little bit of a fruit. There's something going on. There's a little nub there. But before it totally ripens and is edible, it's green. That's the color it is. Green is the color of pre-creation, pre-ripening, before something comes to fruition, pre-revelation, pre-salvation. And if you think about it, Yirak Roket, Esther Yirak Roket. Not only did she embody Tiferet, but she also was the preliminary stages. She was a harbinger of creation, of Yeshua, of something coming to fruition, of the clarity of Hashem in the story of Purim and of the Yeshua. And again, this is the message of the spiritual time of Purim. It's, you know, it's this hidden development, this preliminary development of Yeshua, and it's also in the natural world. In the natural world, what is Purim time? If anyone heard my shiur about Shvat, and one of the ideas about Shvat is that Shvat is the time when the sap just starts moving in the tree, right? It's the Rosh Hashanah. It's, we say it's the beginning of spring, but is it really the beginning of spring? It doesn't look like the beginning of spring. Even in Israel, I don't know if it really looks like the beginning of spring in Shvat. It's a little early, don't you think? You know, it's like Shvat is a time when we think about like the seeds in the ground and they're hidden, and something's just beginning to go, some little motion of growth, of Yeshua, of process of growth and creation is beginning. But in Shvat, like, you really don't see it. You know, there's no real signs of anything happening. It's just under the surface. What happens after Adar, after Purim, is Nisan. In the natural world, Nisan is really spring. You know, the flowers are blossoming and the animals are giving birth and, like, the whole world is coming alive. Like, that's Giloy, and that's the message of the spiritual state of being in Nisan as well. The Nes of Nisan, Kriyas Yam Tov and everything, right? That's, like, the most Giloy Hashem you could have. Adar is right in between. Adar is the green month. It's the Irok month. It's that time where, like, you have a little fruit there. You have a little development. If you look closely at the Megillah, you could see the movement. You see that Hashem is doing something. Something weird is going on, but like, it's Behester. You don't really know what it is. But by the end of the Megillah, then you are right ready. This is, you know, this is like pre-revelation and developing into revelation. It's Esther with her Tiferet developing into Malchut like the moon. It's the growing from Hester to Giloy. It's the Megillah Esther. That's the process of Adar. It's going from Shvat to Nisan. And that's exactly where Tzadok HaGoyim says in the last source, verse 17, he says, Adar hu hachana l'nisan. He says, in a spiritual sense, we should think of it in this way also. We should view Adar as a preparation for Nisan. When we're in Adar, yes, we have to appreciate the here and now and be in the moment of Purim time, but we also should realize that it's also preparation for Nisan. He says, what's Adar Nisan? In Adar, what do we say? We say, you're supposed to get Libesume Ad Lo Yada. Purim is a time of the Lo Yada. We don't really know what's going on. Something's going on. There's some Hester Panim. Hashem is involved in our lives in some way. Maybe we don't know how yet. Hashem is involved in the Megillah. We don't know how yet. You know, the plants are starting to grow under the ground a little bit, but we don't understand how. De Lo Yada. But it's happening, and it's leading up to an Or Bahir of Nisan, a clarity of vision that comes in Nisan, with the Nisan that happens there in Pesach time. And it's very interesting that he uses the Lashon. He says, in Nisan, there's no Halbasha. And whereas what? Whereas in Adar, there is a Halbasha. There's a Levush, right? Levush, what do? On Purim, we dress up. We wear costumes. We cover ourselves. Because things are under the surface. We don't know what's going on exactly, but something's going on. And then Pesach, we don't wear costumes anymore. And he says, V'zeta amash amru mechilta and b'shalach lo negalu el b'tzchut ha'emuna ki b'madze lo yada ve'eno mitzah ha'sechahu rak mikorach ha'emuna shleim v'ashem yibarach v'she'en nikra b'olam rak ha'kol me'ashgach ha'tau. So this time of Purim is really a time to work on our emuna, when it's a time that things are still hidden, but we have an inkling that something might be going, that Hashem might be involved. That's the time to work on our emuna and Hashem's hashgacha, even though we're not using our seichel. And it's through that emuna that that we have a zchus to be redeemed from Mitzrayim. And in Mirat Hashem, we should be able to have that emuna in our time. And in that zchus, we should be able to celebrate. We should be able to celebrate Pesach together with a full clarity of Hashem involved in the world and in our lives, even more than we are able to have now. And just to really finish up, it's interesting, again, to look at what we do on Purim and how it really embodies these ideas, because Purim embodies the idea of Tiferet that we were saying, and it also is this idea of hiddenness, of development of creation. The idea first of all, I'll do the second one first, since we just talked about it. Reb Tzadok talks about a Delo Yada level on Purim and an Or Bahir on Pesach. Really, the Nesiv Shalom says, on Purim, it's not that there's no Or Bahir. The Or Bahir is there. He says there's a special, special hidden light that exists on Purim. Maybe it's the same hidden light as Pesach. I don't know. What do you mean? But that hidden light is Delo Yada. The light is hidden on Purim because it's so, so precious to us. He says on Purim, he gives a muscle. It's like if a king's crown needed to be transported from one place to another. The king's crown jewels, his beautiful crown full of riches, expensive jewels, let's say for some reason they needed to transport it out of the palace for safety or whatever reason, you're not going to bring it on display through the streets. Some robber could come and steal it. That's terrible. No. He says the crown is going to be covered with shabby old, rags, and it's going to be brought on a peasant's wagon. It's not going to be shown off. It's going to be covered in, stum, regular coverings. And that's what happens on Purim. On Purim, there's a pure, beautiful light of Hashem that's hidden there, of Hashgacha and of spirituality that we can access if we just try to on Purim. It's so precious. We can't do it outright. We have to cover it up so people get drunk, so people dress up in costumes. You can't see it so clearly. But if we know that it's there, then we can reach for it and we can access it. And that's the Bina, that's the Yarok of the author of the Tomer Dvorah that's existing in Purim. And where's the Tiferet in Purim? Well, just think about what we do on Purim in a very general way. Tiferet meaning like the middle road. Purim is not just a spiritual holiday. It's Gashmi and it's Ruchmi, right? It's Dafka, the Gashmi holiday. We use the food and the money and all those things for Suda, and that's what the mitzvahs are. And they're involved in the physical world and in the spiritual world. But specifically Tiferet in the sense of Chesed and Gevurah also, because what are the mitzvahs that we're doing on Purim? We're, on one hand, we give, and also Yom Ha'aretz we give. There's, Tzedakah is a big inyan then, and different holidays have different characteristics. But on Purim, we give, there's Matzanos Levyonim, and we give Shachmanos. But on the other hand, we take. We have Chesed, but we also have Gevurah. We also have a Suda where we eat for ourselves. We enjoy ourselves. The Suda is a lot of fun, right? It's delicious. And that's Gevurah. And also, if you think about it, if you have a society of Jews and everyone's giving each other shalachmanos, which is a little bit annoying right before Pesach when everyone's trying to get rid of their chametz, but okay. But we're forced to take as well. All of our neighbors, we're not just showering everyone else with the shalachmanos. We could try to re-gift some of our shalachmanos and give it to other people, but ultimately we have to take as well. And so Purim is also a time of Tiferet in the sense of giving and taking. So really, Hashem should just help us all learn the lessons of Esther and the lessons of Yarok that relate to the Torah and the Beis HaMikdash, and that we see in the Megillah, and we should all be able in the Hashem to grow in these areas of Ruchnius, and develop greater out of Purim, and really to learn these messages, and to be ready for the further Giloy, and the further Ruchnius coming up later in Nisan.